You are listening to www.infinitesmile.org. Enjoy these Zen-inspired talks given by Michael McAllister, followed up by question and answer exchanges with groups of his students.
We talked about the difference between being closed and being open as being the difference between delusion and enlightenment, sleep and wakefulness. And what I'm going to try to do here in the next quick talk is fuse a bit of a bit of an articulation as to how it is that we tend to close down, and then how we can practice being open. Then, of course, we'll take questions. But we look at the hindrances to awakening, the hindrances to being open, as showing up in five really, really distinct ways. In the Buddhist tradition, we look at sensual desire, anger, laziness, restlessness and worry, and then finally doubt. Any one of these five are ways that the ego can manage the situation of what we might call awakening. It can prevent it from happening. Our natural state is one of incredible openness. And what this leads to is an amazing joy. That's our natural state. Joy, then, with a little teeny bit of ego mixed into it, a little bit of a contraction, we can then say is happiness. Okay? Happiness ebbs and flows. But joy, as an expansive state, just like the universe is constantly expanding, when we ourselves are expanding, we experience this joy. What keeps that from happening is a block. In other words, if we're not feeling joy, grace, ease, acceptance, ego has positioned herself right in the way of an oncoming flood of infinity. It's blocking it somehow. Now, how is it that ego can block infinity? Well, it can't, really. But what it can do is it can alter our relationship to infinity. So awakening isn't necessarily suddenly that you are blissed out all the time. It's that that openness informs your activity. That's the completion. It's not just that you, let's say, see the face of God, or you have this kensho or this satori or this vast awakening, and then you stay there. That would be an attachment, wouldn't it? You'd be attaching to the awakening itself, which defiles the awakening and then just turns it into, instead of a trait or a quality that you have, it just turns it into a state, which will always be temporary. So our work is to bring it home. It's to bring it home. Experience the stillness. And then bring it home. In every moment. What gets in the way of that stillness? That which wants to move. The separate self sense is always on the move. It's always on the lookout. It is always ready for an attack and ready to attack. It's ready for preemptive war as much as it's ready for the nuclear option. And it can collectivize, and it can be singular. It can be deeply personal, or it can be with a group that has an orientation towards a particular ideology or conviction. This is fundamentalism. And fundamentalism, even in the form of fundamentalist Buddhism, is nowhere near the vast opening necessary to infuse enlightened embodiment. And where does this come from? Well, we tend to watch ego's moves go in the five ways that I just described. Ego's positioning, it wants to feel good, so it goes after sensual desire. That which feels good. That which tastes good. Any type of sense pleasure, pleasure principle. Freud was right. At least in that capacity. All right? Anger. A disciple of this teaching, a disciple of the awakened truth, as articulated by all the mystics, has a different relationship to anger. Okay? Just like a mother who screams out when her little boy runs through the parking lot at 3 years old in Bullocks, Wilshire. She yells at the top of her lungs. You can tell this is about me, right? When she says, "Michael, damn it!" Was it anger or was it compassion that intensity came from? It was compassion, I hope. And you can you tell us, Mom. But there was incredible fire there in her voice. All right? I'll never forget it. Okay? As a result, I tend not to go running through the parking lot. Ever. Ever. I avoid that at all costs. But do you understand the difference between, I mean, that's not anger. That is crying out. All right? That is protecting. All right? Now we could push that a little further. There was some real significant and healthy attachment from me, not only as a kid, but from Mom as a parent, that generates an ability and a strength and a confidence and an eventual fearlessness to let go of the attachment. Anger is about total resistance to what is. Anger is about resistance to what is showing itself. Compassion is open and loving, and it may be intense, but it most certainly isn't closed. Laziness. Or as my teacher in Thailand used to say, sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor. He was trying to say torpor. T-O-R-P-O-R. It's one of the impediments to an enlightened understanding. In my case, it was just an impediment to understanding at all. He's a phenomenal guy. Ajahn Po. But I, for the longest time, could not understand what the guy was saying. Until I recognized, oh my gosh, he's so right. He's so right. In other words, when I'm feeling, or we are feeling, sloth-like, or just lazy, oh, I just don't feel like doing anything, that really is coming from a place of resistance. It's a form, in other words, of anger, except it's directed inward and it's made quiet. It can be just as destructive. But what we do with laziness is we turn our depression into a behavior. Depressed activity is laziness, in other words. And depression occurs when there's very little sense of joy. There's very little sense of the authentic and natural state of the universe teeming throughout your body. Instead, you're feeling separate. So separate, in fact, so disconnected from the vast expanse that we collapse inward. And this can manifest very easily as laziness. Way to get out of it? Oh, give me something that makes me feel. It's the birth of addiction right there. It begins in our pain and it ends in our pain. So says Eckhart Tolle. Restlessness and worry. Do we scurry about in our day-to-day? Did that hit a nerve? Define scurry, exactly. Yeah, but you know what I mean? I mean, if you are in a situation where you just can't sit still and you have to be doing something, or if you can't be doing something, at least you can think about the future, even though it's not happened yet. And that gap between what has not happened yet and where you are right now is called stress, right? That's worry. Worry is always about some future fantasy that has not yet occurred. But this at least allows ego to be in control. Ego can just keep managing. Ego can keep controlling. Ego can keep driving the bus. And then lastly, and maybe one of the most powerful, is doubt. Doubt is not the same thing as healthy skepticism. Doubt is a negative judgment. A judgment is an egoic attachment. Discriminating awareness is an ego-less openness. Let me play with this a little bit here. There are two kinds of apprehension of what's going on. In other words, we can have either a judgment that is good, that is bad, that is, you know, we can categorize it, which is what ego does brilliantly. Or we can have a discriminating awareness, which is ego-less. Ego is not involved, for instance, in helping you pull your hand away from fire. There's no thought process. There's no identification, in other words, with thought or the separate self-sense. It's just the reaction. It's compassion embodied in that moment. It's not, oh, goodness, this is very intense. This is hurting me now. There are strange smells coming from that direction. Oh, okay. That's not what's happening. It's instant. Just like when you knock your books off your table and you reach to catch them. That's compassion. It's that simple. It's the natural doing to prevent harm. That natural act of preventing harm, we can then see very, very clearly as nothing other than an awareness that can actually have a participatory nature to it. The big self, instead of the contracted self, the big self can actually participate in this world, not by identifying with attachments, with judgments, with compartmentalizations. All that does is diminish and defile experience. Instead, discriminating awareness allows us to be open to things before they become things. In the Blue Cliff Record, has this great quote, and I wish I could remember the case, but as usual, I'm going to just kind of paraphrase here. What is the mountain out there before we label it mountain? What is the tree before we label it a tree? Who am I? Who are you? Before we label each other with names. Nothing other than just a vast expression of the infinite. So imagine yourself as you are driving home this evening, or as you are walking out here on this gorgeous beach. What is it before it becomes a beach? It's nothing other than infinity itself. Just like me. Just like you. And in this is tremendous freedom. the minute we recognize that everything can be met with something open as opposed to something closed, is the minute that we are free from doubt and given the gift of wonder. Wondering is what happens to our minds when our minds are not constricted by fear, by separation. What happens when we're not fearful? We open. The fearlessness then allows the mind to wonder, and in that wondering, everything becomes that wow. Acting from that wow is the embodiment of love. Here's to love. I think I gave it. Yeah. Is it on? Okay. If anybody has a question, I'd be happy to. The young man over here.
I don't understand what you conclude by your comments relative to sensuality.
So in other words,
they all came through to me as badness. Oh. Sensuality as badness. And I see sensuality as goodness.
Right. Are you attached to that?
Yes.
Okay. I think sensuality is neither good nor bad. It's an expression of the universe that is divine. Now, how we deal with that divinity, is it egoic? Is it something we attach to? Or is it something we are totally open to?
Your comment was that it was driven by ego, and ego was
desire.
Bad.
Desire.
Yeah, and you describe that as bad, and I'm saying that I don't see it that way.
Okay.
I mean, I can see the bad in aggressive sensuality, mm-hmm. but I can also see the expression of love, which is remarkable.
And has precisely nothing to do with desire.
Well, I'm sure desire is a part of it too.
Desire, part of what?
Part of that sensuality. But
what I was getting at was love. Love and desire, right?
Mm-hmm.
Love and sensuality. Love is sensuality dances in front of the face of love.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So I
didn't pick up that picture as you were describing it earlier.
Does it look prettier now?
Yeah, much.
Much prettier. But, I mean, your question's great, Skip, because it's not that sensuality is bad. It's that if we are addicted to sense pleasure, all we're doing is perpetuating our own and others' pain. Does that distinction make sense? Is that helpful? Because there is dharma in everything, including the glass of wine, including sexuality, including the cigar, including everything. It includes everything. Now, if our relationship to any of those things that I just kind of pointed out is one that is about grasping, then what we've done is we've set up, rather than an intimacy with our experience, we've set up an egoic clinging to our experience, and the clinging is the delusion, is the the unenlightenment. Mm-hmm. So it's the surrender, but not the pushing away of whatever shows itself. Can you be in a sensual experience? Sex is probably the best way to articulate this, in a sexual experience where the intensity is so great that you're lost, that there is no mind, and there is no self, and there is no other. There is just this moment. We experience that in orgasm all the time, right? That is the essence of the universe's energy. Now, what we find is that we turn that into a craving. Our relationship to that type of experience becomes something we covet, something we want to protect. And then when we lose that ability, what we do is we develop medications that help us get it again. You know? Not that that's wrong, but that we're always going after it creates tremendous suffering if the relationship is about grasping. If, on the other hand, it is about meeting, then it's actually intimate. I guess is the best treatment I could give to the question. And listen, make sure you love your wife, too. It's just very important. She's very special. It's a very special lady. You mean to my mother?
You being attached to your mother.
I am attached beyond imagination to my mother and to my wife and to you and to everybody here and to this planet. And I know that I better enjoy it while I've got it, because I don't even have it. It's already gone. The plates are already broken. The death has already happened. Now, what happens when, in the world of form, all this is taken from me? I have no idea. I have no idea what my reaction is going to be. But I can prepare for it right now. Right now, knowing that it's temporary. Right now, knowing that every single one of you will leave. Every bit of this Sangha will dissolve. This earth is temporary, because it's a thing. What is not temporary is spirit. Stillness. Stillness never moves. If it never moves, it can't be born. If it can't be born, it cannot die. If it cannot die, be born, I mean, it's beyond time. If it is beyond time, immediately prior to time, we have freedom. This is eternal life. This is what Christ was talking about. This is what the Buddha talked about. They're pointing right at this very, very simple realization, which is that this stillness that we can embody as we sit, or as we walk, or as we dine, or as we make love, or as we run, the stillness that we can experience there is precisely that in us which will never die and is equal in all its radiance to every other thing on this planet and every other non-thing on this planet. It is the deep singularity, and it takes courage to kind of fall into that, to fall awake. But that's the work.
So, is that what we call God? What you just described?
What I just described, we can give it the name God, but remember, the name diminishes that entire thing. Yeah.
Some of us only have our voices.
Yeah, and the work is to get beyond the voice, and we do. Mm-hmm. We get beyond the voice, and we get beyond the thought, and we get beyond the feeling by going inward. Instead of it, what it does is it reaches onto the other side. It reaches China. It's like digging a hole in the ground all the way till you reach China. All right. Similarly, in this work of stillness, what happens is we literally dig into the other side of time, the other side of we go beyond time and mind. And what is beyond time and mind is not something we can articulate directly. We can give it names, and we can point to it. We can use words that act as road signs, like God, like being, like witness, like stillness, spirit, whatever words we want to use. But even the realization of this is precisely not God. It is merely the realization of it. And I'm not trying to get hyper-esoteric as much as it is just to recognize that what we endeavor to do is create a stillness that cultivates and tills the soil of our soul so that there can be a flowering, that things can arise from it. And if you want to call that God, be my guest. Just make sure you let go of that name.
So you talked about five impediments, and basically they're a construction of the ego.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the path to? What do you do about it? I mean,
once you can recognize, yeah, it's easy for us to recognize, for instance, each of those five hindrances, right?
Mm-hmm.
The next step in the process is to watch them as they occur with every bit of your attention. So as you watch desire, sensual desire come up, it's not that you watch a sensual experience and negate it. Don't ever do that. But also, don't take a sensual experience and start to just try to get, you know, just get more and more and more. That becomes greed. So you don't want to avert it, and you don't want to go get greedy with it. Watch it. How does it strike your body? Note. Witness. Pay attention. Full attention to everything that starts happening in your body. Same thing with each of the others. The minute laziness comes up, look at it. Study it.
Become intimate with it.
Intimate with the experience. And in that intimacy, what happens is there develops a space. You know, we've talked about this space that develops between you and the experience itself. That space allows us to identify the hindrance and simultaneously disidentify that experience with ourself.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than being caught by laziness, rather than being caught by anger, we can experience anger. And that which is experiencing the anger becomes our center of psychological and spiritual gravity. And there's so much more to that. There's so much more freedom in that space than in the contracted space. So by studying the self, we actually forget the self, to quote Dogen. And in forgetting the self, we become enlightened by all things. And in this way, every single thing offers us a direct path to enlightenment. Everything. Everything in our awareness that arises. If we can study it, we can be free of it. And in that freedom, we can suddenly recognize that we are all things. We are all things.
What I see, when you become intimate with it, you also contact a compassion for yourself in relation to that
mm-hmm.
impediment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Healing.
Oh, absolutely. Compassion is another way of saying it might be to say it's love without any type of covetous or jealous nature mixed into it at all. It's love without any egoic attachment, in other words. It's compassion. So there are two kinds of love. There's the romantic, blissful love, and then there's the infinite love. And the romantic love, usually, if it is born from the infinite love, becomes not only healing, but transcendent. If we build a relationship solely on romantic love, when the romance, the fire, starts to cool, we tend to look for other ways of getting it back. And that's pretty difficult. So orienting our entire experience from that infinite spaciousness, that infinite version, if you will, of love, the same kind of love you can feel for your grocery clerk, orienting ourselves from that place, that allows us to literally embody love, embody compassion. And we recognize ourselves in the eyes of others. Their radiance is our radiance.